Welcome, everyone, to episode 366 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and today we are going to preview game four of the NBA finals, both the what if Bam does come back and what if Bam doesn't come back scenarios. Then we're going to get into some Buddy Hield trade discussion and wrap up with some talk about Victor Oladipo and the Knicks. Before we get into all of that, a reminder, you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bios to give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews. And we are being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Joining me today is a guy who is fiending to talk about Jimmy Butler, Morten Jensen. How's it going?
You know what, Brian? It was going very well earlier today. And then I had to, well, actually, I dared writing in my native tongue on Twitter. And I apparently shouldn't have, because the American followers that I have are like, oh, he tweeted in Danish for an hour. That's an immediate unfollow, which is, and it happens like clockwork. Whenever I do like Danish Q&As, it's at least 5 to 10 followers, if not more, at the very least, every single time. It's very weird. Like it has a Google Translate button or a Bing Translate button or whatever.
Just use it. Yeah. I mean, I sent this to you earlier, but it really does remind me of Geno Stakes back in the post 9/11 days in Philly had a sign that said, you're in America, so order in English or something like that. And they even sold shirts, one of which I did purchase just because I thought it was absurd. it's just like so blatantly offensive that I in my twisted brain, I thought like, yeah, I'll support that. I was also like 17 at the time, so forgive me. but yeah, you will be doing this whole podcast in Danish, actually. So luckily.
Oh, yeah. 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 Okay. That you just made that up, but I could, and it would serve those people right.
Right. Yeah. Just sprinkle in some Danish words now and then, and I'll assume you're cursing at me. It'll be fine.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you didn't do anything wrong yet. So.
Right. That's true.
But I will say this. It's difficult to curse at this point when we have to talk about Jimmy Butler, because what he did was just extraordinary. Like that was that, you know, I've been pretty fortunate with what he did, because I have had a huge debate going with my employer or some of my colleagues at TV2, like, is Jimmy Butler a superstar? And most of them are like, no, he's half a superstar. That's what they've told me repeatedly. He's half a superstar.
What does that mean?
He doesn't
mean?
Score enough.
What does half a superstar mean?
Half a superstar means he's not right at that echelon of the great ones. And I'm just like, no, listen, he defends at an extremely high level. He's a tremendous playmaker. Over the course of his career, he's also been just elite at protecting the basketball. Like, despite handling the ball at severe high volumes, he just rarely turns it over. Look at what he did back in Chicago. I mean, he averaged almost 24 points a game despite, you know, playing with Rajon Rondo and Dwayne Wade and no spacing whatsoever. Like, that year, 2016-2017, the Bulls ranked 29th. So second to last in the NBA in three-point field goal attempts and 28th in makes. And yet somehow here's Jimmy Butler averaging almost 24 points a game on good percentages, no less, and like dishing and diming and doing all the things that you need without any spacing. So the whole, well, he's not that good of a scorer argument is just out of the window. I think that is just preposterous. And then after that game where he dropped the 40-point triple-double and brought the Heat back to win, I had so many Danish people reach out like, okay, yep, well, we hear you, Mort. Like, I had aired my Jimmy Butler is better than James Harden idea on a Danish pod, and I actually forgot to bring it up when we had Alana on, because I'm there. I think at the very, very least, it's a debate. It's a legitimate debate, and I am on that side where if you're telling me I can have James Harden and Jimmy Butler going into a playoff series, I would take Jimmy Butler. I just would. I think the baseline is just higher. I would agree that scoring-wise, Harden's ceiling is higher, but I think Jimmy is just, in terms of the two-way play, the reliability, the ball handling, like the playmaking, I think is yeah, Harden is a bit better of a playmaker, but I don't think it's by much. But the defense is what does it for me. Like it's doing whatever is needed to do, which we saw the other night. I mean, my God, he did literally everything.
Yeah, I mean, I think for that question in particular, the who would you rather have, Harden or Butler, like, it unquestionably, Harden is a better scorer than Jimmy Butler.
Right.
I don't think you can argue that. Right. I mean, just shooting-wise, like, Harden brings a lot more to the table than Jimmy. But, as you said, the two-way play at least narrows the margin between the two, and I think that's ultimately what you have to ask in the playoffs is, what would you rather have? A guy who is elite on one end and, you know, below average to average on the other. I'm not saying James Harden is Trae Young on defense. He's not the worst defender in the NBA, but he's not elite by any means. He's a good post defender, but, you know, gets lost off the ball in particular a ton. And Jimmy Butler does have legit lockdown ability on defense. So, you know, when teams are scheming to take away your strengths in the playoffs and have, you know, watch film of you over and over again, I think it might be easier to scheme out an elite guy on one end and a mediocre guy on the other versus a guy like Jimmy, who I don't know that he has any one truly elite skill. Like, one thing that he is top five in the NBA in, but he's just like a really, really well-rounded, very good at pretty much everything other than shooting the three. And he's even willing to do that at times. He's hit some big threes in the playoffs. So it's harder to scheme out a guy like Jimmy Butler than it is James Harden. I'll give you that for sure.
Right. And I think that boils it down pretty well, because that's what you want in the playoffs. You want someone who just is not a liability anywhere, who can provide a steady contribution while also hitting a pretty high ceiling. I would argue that when you are missing two of your key starters, you're down 0-2 to the Los Angeles Lakers in the NBA Finals, led by LeBron James, and you respond with a 40-point triple-double, I would argue that's a pretty high ceiling.
Yeah, and I mean, going back to, like, that's why I was asking what constitutes a half superstar. Like, was it they think he's a superstar on defense and not offense, or they think he's, like, one tier below on both sides? Because, I mean,
it's a good question. I don't think I know their full rationale, because I was already, as soon as they said half's a superstar, I was like, nope,
yeah.
I'm closing it off. I'm closing the debate off.
And I mean, I think it's reductive to boil it down to this, but I think it's also in part true. A superstar is a guy who can get to the line 14 times in a game. Like, yeah. That is often the mark of a top X player. And I mean, that's, you know, for a guy like Jimmy in particular, who isn't a great three-point shooter, isn't a high-volume three-point shooter, he didn't take a three. He didn't take a single three-point attempt, and he scored 40 points. You know why? Because he was sizzling from the field, 14 of 20. But he also got to the line 14 times, and that's a big part of his game. That's a part of the game, you know, that the Sixers were really missing this past year, that he took a large number of their free throw attempts and when he was on the ball. It's like, he is a slasher, he's a driver, and he's going to get fouled. I think, you know, honestly, it wouldn't surprise me if he picked that up from his time in Chicago playing alongside Derrick Rose, who had a very similar offensive game, very poor three-point shooter, but elite athletically, at least before all the injuries, drove, slash, got to line a ton.
Yeah, I think you're right. And also worth noting in that game, by the way, Jimmy had zero fouls. Like, he did not put himself in a position where he would be forced to go to the bench or, like, limit himself. Like, he didn't even compromise the defense. Like, he was right there every single step of the way.
Yeah.
For 45 damn minutes, Brian.
Yeah.
I mean, Mike, this was like an all-timer.
I mean, it was. He's, I think, what, one of only three players in NBA history with a 40-point triple-double in the finals?
Yeah. Yeah. LeBron and Jerry West. Yeah.
And then he's the only player ever to outproduce LeBron in all three categories in a finals game?
Yeah, something like that as well.
Yeah. Like, without question, this was one of the best games of Jimmy Butler's career, like, regardless of circumstances, but given the narrative heft behind it, I think that was the best game of Jimmy Butler's career, hands down.
Yeah, I would agree.
So, Mort, let's get into game four, which is tonight. I want to break it down in two ways, because as of the time we are recording, it's about 2 p.m. East Coast time. We don't know if Bam Adebayo is playing tonight. He has been upgraded to questionable. I think he is going to play. I think he's going to do everything in his power to play. So right. let's assume, let's go into the what if Bam does play, and then we'll look at the counter momentarily. So if Bam Adebayo does play, how does that change the game for Miami?
Oh, it changes it dramatically. So when the Heat came out to Game 3, Rachel Nichols was asking Jimmy Butler, like, oh, you got a pep in your step. Like, what are you, have you figured something out, like, by watching film? And he was almost giddy about it. And it was, after the game, he explained, well, we needed to rebound. We went out and we had to rebound the ball. We just didn't rebound in the first two games. So for them to realize that we have to put a tremendous amount of focus on rebounding, you know, that's obviously huge without Bam, but with Bam, that gives them an extra layer of, I don't know how to put this, like, assurances, like, because you do get a guy in who's averaging like 10 to 11 boards a game. So you already did well in that department in Game 3, so now getting someone of his caliber in there, that could bring you over the top once again. So his rebounding, obviously his playmaking, his defense, like, those are three major components, and I'm not even looking at his offense yet, where he's also really good. Mm-hmm. So earlier in the playoffs, before he went down, I wrote an article on him at Danish TV2, where I basically looked at, you know, when he's in a scoring position, he more or less shoots immediately. Like, he has the ball predominantly for less than 2 seconds. And then he shoots.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because he finds those small cuts. Like, he doesn't spend a lot of time posting up, like, you know, backing his defender down. He's not that type of guy. He's a guy who'll sneak around, find the open spot, catch the ball, and then do something with it, either being a pass or a shot. So he's very determined when he gets the basketball, is my point. So when you get someone in there like that, who doesn't milk the clock as much, and just produces as soon as the ball hits his hands, that's a tremendous luxury. And I think to get that back, especially as an alley-oop threat and someone who can just suck in the defense near the basket, especially Anthony Davis, who you know is a very strong defender in his own right. But if Davis is tasked with that Adebayo, like, you've got to stick to him. You can't leave him too much and go out and, like, challenge the mid-range area. You just can't. You've got to stick with Bam. Otherwise, that's an oop. That's an easy drop-off. And right there, he's got the score. So that would help Miami tremendously if he's back and fully healthy.
Yeah. And you know, since you focused on the offense, I'll focus on the defense, because I think, honestly, that's where I would be most optimistic about his chances of helping. I don't know. I mean, who knows what condition that shoulder is going to be in. I think it's fair to say he's not going to be 100%. So I don't think they're going to say, like, Bam, take a ton of jump shots. You know, I think...
Right. Which shoulder was it again? I don't even remember. Was it the right shoulder?
I think it was the left, but I can't remember off the top of my head.
Oh, but if it's the right, that would definitely, you know, potentially at least, limit him offensively as well.
Yeah. And either way, I mean, I think they'll... My guess is if he plays, they're going to shoot him up with a painkiller beforehand so he can't feel what damage he's doing to his body. But I don't expect him to be 100% or right. even close to it. I think, you know, the fact he
just
was...
Just don't puncture his lung.
Right, yeah. But, you know, the fact he was ruled out for games 2 and 3 suggests, like, if this was the regular season, we would not be seeing Bam Adebayo throughout for at least another week or two, would be my guess.
Right. I don't think we would have seen him if Miami had lost the game.
Yeah, I agree with that too. Yeah. But defensively, I mean, those first two games, Anthony Davis was just having his way with mm-hmm. the Heat. And they, you know, they put Jay Crowder on him at first, and Jay just stood no chance. And, you know, it's through no fault of Jay's. Like, he's a good defender in his own right. It's just like Anthony Davis has a size advantage, and he's just been absolutely unreal for mid-range in particular. So, right. you know, getting Bam back, even in game one, they started with Jay on Anthony Davis. But, you know, I think as the series progresses, they probably would have shifted more toward Bam on AD, just seeing what AD was doing. So just having another option to throw at AD would be huge. But, you know, they didn't have Bam in game 3, and AD... He had 6 of 9 shooting, but he only had 15 points and 5 rebounds. They took him out of that game, especially compared to, you know, game 1 and 2. Game 2, he had 32 points and 14 rebounds, 15 of 20 shooting. So if they can limit what AD does, like what damage he does offensively, with or without Bam, they've got a real shot tonight.
Yeah, I would agree. I do. If I'm Miami, though, I am slightly worried about the Lakers shooting just returning to, you know, to norm, or, mm-hmm. or at least like the averages get evened out, right? Because mm-hmm. ultimately, when you have a guy like KCP who is shooting 25% from downtown, or Danny Green who's shooting 20% from downtown, you know, those are inclined to level out at some point. And if that's tonight and the shooters get cooking, oh boy, they're going to be in for a long night.
Yeah. So the one thing I don't know how to phrase this necessarily, because it's going to sound like a critique of Bam, and I don't mean it to be, but you know, Bam, even when he's healthy, is not a long range threat at all. So the right. Heat without him have basically been playing Butler with 4 shooters at all times. Is there a chance that Bam's return, at least offensively, could, I don't want to say like hurt more than help, but you know what I mean? Like he could right. the fact that they're making it easier on the Lakers by reducing the number of floor spacers they're playing with Jimmy Butler, could that end up, you know, doing some damage at least?
Yeah, I mean, technically, yes. I will say as much. Kelly Olynyk has been really good. I mean, he's been hitting the shots that he's gotten. And he's also a really good passer. That's something we usually forget about Kelly Olynyk. Like, he is able to make some pretty wicked passes when you look at it. Mm-hmm. He's just not that defensive guy. He's not the athletic guy who'll finish over the top of guys, right? That's Bam. So he doesn't have the athleticism. And I think offensively, Olynyk does pair, you know, in a better life, better light, rather, to Jimmy than Bam does, at least on paper. I think what Bam gives you offensively, as I outlined a little bit earlier, is tremendously valuable. But I do wonder if he also needs to be flanked by 4 shooters, mm-hmm. meaning that when he's on the court, maybe Jimmy should take a breather. So, like, maybe you should stagger them a little bit. It's a good question, and it's something the Heat would need to figure out in this series, because, you know, when you don't have Duncan Robinson at his best, like, he's also just shooting 25% from 3, and he is rushing the ever-living hell out of those shots, mm-hmm. it does become a problem. I think if Miami was to have, like, one major weakness offensively, it's just shooting the basketball. They have the guys who can do it, but you just have to wonder, can those guys play at the same time, all of them? And so far, it doesn't seem so.
Right. Yeah, and you know, I know the guys in Miami, I think Spo and Butler both have really been on Duncan Robinson, telling him, you got to shoot more. Like, we know you haven't found your range yet, but right. you know, I think Butler was saying, like, we know Duncan's going to have one of those games where he knocks down 6 or 7 threes, and that could be the difference in that game. So, yeah, while you are right to point out that KCP and Danny Green haven't gotten going for the Lakers, you know, you could make the same argument for really both Tyler Hero and Duncan Robinson. Yeah. And I trust those guys more. I think even though they're younger and less proven on this stage in particular, like, they are better shooters than Danny Green, who is notoriously streaky, and KCP, who's been better on that end, but still can be streaky at times. So, like, I have more faith in one of those guys going off than I do, you know, KCP going off for 6 threes.
Yeah, no, I agree with. I think for the Lakers, it's not about, like, one guy splashing 6 threes necessarily. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of, you know, can Kentavious Caldwell-Pope and Danny Green, just both of them get somewhat hot individually. Like, if both of them go, like, 3 of 5, for example, yeah. which is not necessarily high volume, but it's just enough to get them over the hump. Like, maybe that's a scenario that you have to look at. Like, hell, even Rajon Rondo, who shot better in the playoffs, is at 33%. Normally, we would say that's a pretty good percentage for him. But in the playoffs specifically, he's done better.
Mm-hmm. Regardless of whether Bam does or does not return tonight, we agree Kelly Olynyk needs to stay a fixture in the Miami rotation. Yes?
Yeah. Absolutely. Offensively, he's just been such a great bailout option, especially for Jimmy Butler. It seems that he really understands that when Jimmy is attacking off a certain angle, you know, he has to move very specifically to one place because he just knows, okay, that this is where the defender is going to collapse on him. So I'm just going to move when my defender or my opponent has his head turned, and then I'm going to spot up from free, regardless of where I am, really, whether it's a corner, whether it's high, you know, straight on or at the break. Like he can shoot it from anywhere. And I think that's just a tremendous component for Miami to play in on.
Yeah. And, you know, he was fantastic in game two, 24 points, 9 rebounds off the bench. Still very good in game three as well, 17 points, 7 rebounds, and 3 threes, 2 steals. Like Myers Leonard was the nominal starter in both games, but Myers Leonard got subbed out very quickly in both games and Olynyk played. So, you know, if Bam does return, I would expect to see Bam starting most likely, but it wouldn't shock me if Olynyk played more minutes than Bam.
Right. Also, while we're on the subject of the Heat, I know he shot well this series, but Kendrick Dunn is at 62% shooting, which objectively is great. Mm-hmm. But why do you have him handle the basketball as much as he has done? Like he is just not a good, you know, a dribbler or a playmaker.
Right.
Like he's played 69 minutes in this series, which ranks, let me just see, sixth on the roster, and he has the second most turnovers by anyone on Miami in this series.
Not great.
It's not great. Like you, if you want to utilize Kendrick Nunn, I think you have to run him so much more off the ball, and that's where I wonder if Bam is the, if that's an active for Bam to have, like when he comes in, maybe you have Kendrick Nunn just running around the perimeter, hitting threes and cutting to the basket, and Bam being, you know, with Jimmy out, obviously, with Bam being the playmaker. I don't know if that's a component that they could lean in on.
Yeah, no, that's it. That's a very good call. I mean, I think, you know, why they're playing him on the ball as much as they are is obviously Goran Dragic is hurt. And it does not sound like Dragic is going to make it back in this series, just reading the tea leaves. So I think it's really...
No, but I would rather have the ball go through the hands of Tyler Hero and Andre Iguodala, honestly. Mm-hmm. I think Iguodala, that's one of the things I've been missing a little bit. Like, you know, he's a good ball handler and a good passer. And he's been on the court a ton, like almost 23 minutes a game, which, you know, doesn't sound like a lot, but you know, he's 36. So I think that's a substantial minutes load. Like, have him handle the offense then. Mm-hmm. Like, just don't let Kendrick Nunn be your typical point guard. Just run him off the ball.
Right. So let's assume now, worst case scenario, Bam does not come back tonight. Mm-hmm. Do you think what we saw from the Heat in game three is replicable? And like, did they actually figure something out? You mentioned the rebounding, of course, you know, something else, like they shifted away from zone defense, but was it, you know, a schematic thing, or was it just like they were down 2-0, they came out and played harder, and the Lakers thought they were going to be on cruise control to the title, and now it's like, oh, okay, the Lakers are going to actually play hard in game four?
I think it was a combination of those two things. Like, absolutely, the Lakers didn't play hard. And that would also, that's also something that Miami has to be concerned about right now. Like, the game is, you know, 6 hours away or so. Like, Coach Spo right now has to be sitting back going, yeah, they're going to come out like gangbusters now because LeBron is going to be on their ass about their performance in game three. Right. So how do we respond to that? Do we just, do we get hit in the mouth early? And then lay out a plan for if that happens, here's our counterattack, you know, from the second quarter and onwards. Mm-hmm. Like, he has to understand, like, he better than anyone, I think, knows how LeBron thinks and how he's wired. So I think that's an asset, by the way. But no, it's definitely a combination of the two, because you just saw them, the Heat, rather, coming in into the game three, completely locked in and playing with a sense of desperation. And I think that is just so crucial when you're in the finals. You have to play as if your life depended on it if you want to get out victorious.
Mm-hmm.
They have to match that intensity. Is that realistic? It beats me. I'm not expecting Jimmy Butler to drop a 40-point triple-double again. That would be ridiculous. And if he did, you know, good luck telling me he's not a superstar.
Right.
But no, you need to have a plan in place, because this was that was just a Jimmy Butler game, right? He did everything. Like, he dictated the entire offense, ran every play. You can't rely on that again. So now you have to go to a different well. Like, who's going to be the guy tonight? Is it going to be Tyler Hero? Like, you brought him up earlier. He could be a guy who could, you know, shoot his way out of a slump. He's shooting 35% from the field in this series. Like, statistically speaking, he's due.
Right.
So, you know, there are a lot of moving parts. This is the NBA Finals. We can't say that something working one night is going to work on a different night. Everything is very much flexible, and every game has its own identity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good way to put it. Yeah, I mean, if you're banking on a 40-point triple-double from Jimmy Butler again tonight, that is probably a losing strategy. Not to say that Jimmy won't come out with the same mentality, but, you know, again, right. It's like, that was a all-timer game from Jimmy Butler. It's just unrealistic to expect anyone to play that well again and again and again.
Right.
Unless their name is LeBron James.
Speaking of, you and I agree that LeBron is probably too prideful not to take on Jimmy early tonight, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I think if Jimmy gets it going early, LeBron's calling for that matchup for sure.
Okay. See, this is interesting to me, because I think LeBron's pride could go, you know what, like, Frank, I'm going to take him right from the get-go. Like, I don't care. I'm taking Jimmy right from the tip-off, and I'm running with him every step of the way. And if that turns true, this is where I hope Coach Spo already anticipates it a little bit. So he already set up a lot of play designs with Jimmy as a decoy, like, kind of hopefully, you know, putting LeBron in a situation where you just remove him as a defensive unit on the floor, because he's just glued to Jimmy, and that's the anticipation of it.
Yeah. I could definitely see that. The question from the Lakers' perspective, I think, is, you know, especially if Bam doesn't play, how do you get Anthony Davis back on track, considering what he did in those first two games, and then considering what a clunker he had in game three? Foul trouble was obviously, it played a part, but that doesn't explain away everything.
Yeah, I think you got to go to him early and often. That seems to be the way that he does things. Like, it's up and down. We actually raised this issue early in the playoffs, or I don't even remember if it was the playoffs or if it was the start of the bubble, but remember there was a 25-point swing in whether or not the Lakers lost or won with Davis?
Mm-hmm.
Like, for him, his scoring average would fluctuate 25 points on those splits. It's just simple math. When he plays well, they win. When he doesn't, they tend to lose a lot, because he's such a vital component. And I think for them, even if he isn't the most efficient, which he has been, by the way, so far in this series, I think you kind of need to just give him the ball and tell him it doesn't matter if you don't, you know, hit all of your five first shots. It's fine. Just see if you can find a rhythm early. And if you can't, it's going to be a LeBron game. But we want you guys to be in, like, this cohesive rhythm unit. So let's see what you have. Like, let's see if you can get yourself cooking and get those 12, 14 first quarter points.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think the Heat, knowing how critical he is, have been less shy about throwing doubles his way. And they just different defensive looks at him. But especially, I saw some late traps from them that seemed to fluster AD. So I think, you know, the Lakers have now seen kind of their strategy. Like, the Heat went a lot of zone in games one and two, and the Lakers just picked it apart. So the Heat went more man-to-man in game three and mixed up their coverages. Now the Lakers have that on tape, so they're going to, you know, they've had 2 days to figure out how to counter that, and the Heat have to plan for that. Like, they know, okay, the Lakers are going to figure out something else. No, we need to stay one step ahead of that. So what is that strategy? I don't think it's going back to the zone. I mean, I think they are going to stay more man tonight, just because that seemed to be more effective. But regardless of whether Bam plays or not, I mean, you know, keeping AD, as you said, I mean, the efficiency is less of a concern. It's just limiting the damage he does as a scorer. If you're taking the ball out of his hands, he only had 9 shot attempts in game three. He could go 9 for 9. That's still a giant win for Miami. This guy should be shooting 20 times a game. I mean, he's that important to what the Lakers do. So if they can just ball deny Anthony Davis, that's, you know, that's something that could swing this game and this series in Miami's favor.
Right. I mean, going into this series, you and I basically agreed that it was fine if Davis could beat them. Like, if you, or, you know, if you just basically said, LeBron James.
Right. Right. Right.
You and I agreed that if you just let LeBron James run amok, but you could somehow neutralize Davis, you could somehow get a handle on the shooters, like, you would live with LeBron averaging 46 per game.
Mm-hmm.
And Davis is just, he's so good. And he, at this point in his career, he's just so polished that I think throwing this ideology at him, saying, oh, well, if you can nullify Anthony Davis, that's basically a non-starter. He's just too good. He's in that category now where you kind of say, well, we can't limit him. The only thing we can do is just make every shot as hard as possible because he's just that good. So if that's the mindset you have coming in, then you need to basically say, okay, the game plan's changed. Now it's let's let LeBron James and Anthony Davis beat us, and let's see if we can shut down everyone else. The problem is, though, LeBron James and Anthony Davis together can absolutely beat you.
Right. Therein lies the dilemma that every team so far has faced with them.
These guys,
it's just you have two top five-ish players in the league. Like, it's incredibly hard to stop one of them, much less two.
Right. I mean, if one is off, the other is on. It's just,
yeah.
It's a constant pain. when I look at the roster and when I, like, my mind go through the series, I also want to say, like, Markieff Morris stands to be, like, the biggest, or has, you know, already been the biggest benefactor and probably remains the biggest benefactor of the attention that James and Davis gets, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, so many open threes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's averaging 11 points, almost 11 and 5 per game, and he's playing less than 20 minutes a night. Like, that is one of those guys that Miami just needs to take out immediately.
Yeah, I mean, he has a team-high 9 made three-pointers, 9 of 19 from 3. You know, it's small sample size that could always reverse, but it could always go the other way, too, and he could have a game where he hits 5 of 7, and you know, getting that off the bench, you know, that was one of the factors we identified coming into the series. Like, Miami, you know, of course LA has the two best players, but Miami had 3 through 6 3 through 7. Obviously injuries changed that calculus somewhat, but you know, you needed Miami's supporting cast to beat LA's, and I don't think that was the case in games 1 and 2, even game 3. I mean, Morris and Kuzma each had 19 off the bench. It was just, you know, Howard, Green, KCP combined for 11, whereas,
right,
you know, Tyler Hero would have been on the bench, so he had 17 in the starting lineup. Olynyk had 17 off the bench as well. So Miami's supporting cast did outplay LA's. You need that formula to continue as well going into game 4 and beyond.
Yeah, totally agree.
So, gun to your head, if Bam plays today, let's start there, who do you think wins?
So I do think that the return of Bam can give Miami some extra motivation.
Mm-hmm.
But I hate the idea of going up against LeBron after a loss. So I'm rooting for Miami for this game because I want this series to go long. Because we don't know when basketball returns, so yes. I would do anything to just extend this series as much as possible, but I think the Lakers are going to take a 3-1 lead tonight.
Yeah, I would agree, regardless of whether Bam does or does not play.
Right.
But like you, I'm rooting for this series to go on, not only because, I mean, it sounds like we're going to be without basketball for a few months at least, but also I would like, you know, I think if we start to get wind of, you know, Miami wins tonight, now Bam is back, and he gets 2 days off after this to recover, they've won 2 straight, all the momentum is on their side. You know, the ratings for the NBA Finals have not been great, in part because, It's happening in October. It's going up against MLB playoffs and NFL, which it doesn't usually have to contend with. I think if we start to hear, oh, LeBron might blow a 2-0 lead in the finals, ratings could start to pick up a little bit. So the NBA's sake, I hope this thing goes long as well.
So one thing I haven't seen this being brought up, and I don't know if I'm way off base. I could easily be off base. Do you think that finals ratings could be a LeBron James symptom, because we're so used to seeing him there? Like, it's LeBron James fatigue.
I mean, I think it's possible. I honestly think there are a number of factors going into this. The one thing I don't think is the get woke, go broke BS. Oh,
God. No, definitely not.
Yeah, because, the NFL also got woke this year. Their ratings are fine. It's just, everyone is, there's so many sports going on. This year has just been a cluster. And, honestly, I mean, a lot of people are probably too preoccupied with everything else going on to care about sports right now. And, casual fans might not be tuned into the NBA like they otherwise would be in the middle of June when nothing else is going on. It's
right.
I think there are a lot of factors. And, unfortunately, I hope the NBA doesn't read into this more than necessary. I think it's a one-off, but
yeah.
I guess we'll see next year.
Yeah, no, I totally hear it. Besides, if you follow basketball for a while, especially the NBA, I have a feeling that getting woke isn't a problem.
Right. It's, something tells me you were already on board with a lot of this stuff.
Right, exactly. But yeah. I do think it's interesting because you raise a really good point. So obviously the diehards, the super diehards, are tuning in, as they always do. The entirety of NBA Twitter, they're tuning in. Mm-hmm. But as you said, the crowd that flips on and off here and there, the casual observers, some of them might have lost their jobs, or some of them might have lost a loved one because of all this. Maybe sports or basketball or whatever just is not in their field of priorities at all right now, which could play a big factor. I think that's a really good point. And now that I just said not tuning into a game, that reminds me, we actually need to send a shout out to a friend of the podcast who did not see Game 3 because he was moving to Australia.
Oh, I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah, Sam Vecini. So he just moved to Melbourne, was it?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess his wife is from there. So we're gonna try to bully him into doing a 3-continent pod before draft season.
Mark Karansoulis has just officially been replaced as our coach to Australia. No, but that so shout out to Sam. That's a hell of a decision, and that's awesome. Probably a pretty good time to make that transition.
Right. I was gonna say, it's good to know that is still on the table, that Americans are allowed to leave. I was starting to wonder, but
well, I mean, hey, in that case, you and Alex are certainly welcome over here.
We've still got a couple more years to serve here, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, we'll see if you make it.
That's true.
Yeah.
All right. Let's turn now more to Buddy Hield, because there is a story from Jason Jones in The Athletic. I think this was on Friday, where he reported, Hield has soured on head coach Luke Walton to the point that he will not answer his phone calls. Frustration has been percolating for a while now, I think it's fair to say. He got pulled from the starting lineup back in January, I believe, and made it very clear at the time that he was not a huge fan of that decision. It seems, Hield has been trolling a bit on social media, liking a lot of things related to the 76ers in particular, because he has become a favorite of Sixers Twitter for a trade target. So, I mean, Mort, what do you think the likelihood is of, not necessarily the Kings sending him to Philly, but the Kings cutting bait on Buddy this offseason and, respecting his wishes to start anew somewhere else?
Well, they are basically telling Luke Walton that he's got a job there because he's going to be back for next season. So mm-hmm. I have to assume on some level that they're willing to accommodate him to a certain extent, meaning Buddy Hield is probably available in trade talks, even though he 100% shouldn't be. this is a ridiculous handling of the situation if you're the Sacramento Kings. Surprise, surprise. And it just goes to show once again that organization is just like whenever they do something good for a while, like they'll find a way to mess it up and restart mm-hmm. everything all over. And if Buddy Hield is going to be the latest victim of that, then good on Buddy Hield for hopefully getting out of that situation. Like him not responding to Luke Walton's phone calls, that only makes me want him even more.
Right.
that is objectively smart. And by the way, something is hitting me right now. That it's almost a year ago that he got benched.
Yeah.
When the season returns, he would have been benched for a full calendar year. This is 2020. Right. My God. Okay. Yeah.
I agree with you. I will ask this. Mm-hmm. What do you think, Buddy, his ideal role is? Do you think he can be a starting two guard on a good team? Or do you think, you know, was Luke onto something in seeing what he could bring off the bench?
No, I think it's fine to experiment. I don't have a problem with experimenting whatsoever. And I will say this. Buddy Hield, you know, he made his best Zach LaVine impression when he got moved to the bench. Mm-hmm. He kind of wanted to show Luke Walton up. He was like, you know what? If you are going to disrespect me this way, I am going to absolutely tear you a new one. And I'm pretty sure that Luke Walton's like was rubbing his hands together, seeing my plan is working. But you also have to factor in team chemistry. You also have to factor in if a player is happy or not. Because over an extended period of time, that player's play is going to diminish. And we saw that. We saw that. I mean, just in the bubble. Let me bring up the bubble numbers real quick. So, yeah. In the bubble, Buddy Hield played just 21 minutes a game. And he averaged 14.3 points per game. That is not optimized Buddy Hield whatsoever. Like, mentally, he was checked out. He was done. So if you as a coach determines, well, this is my best plan, this is the best course of action I can take, then you probably shouldn't be a head coach because that's a dumbass plan to take.
Right.
And as for your question in regards to Hield individually and his future, yes, of course he can. Of course, when you are an elite shooter, look, Duncan Robinson right now is a starting forward on an NBA Finals team. Of course, Buddy Hield can be a starter on a very, very good team. Yes, because he can move without the basketball and he can actually create. 42% of his own offense was self-created. Mm-hmm. People may not know that. People will look at him as a sort of a spot-up shooter, which he absolutely is elite at, but he can also create something off the dribble. Now, if he goes to the right team with the right coach and that coach tells him, you know what, I would like to move you off the ball even more, just so you can optimize your primary strength, I actually think Buddy Hield would be okay with it as long as he got the starting position and as long as he had a coach who knows what he's doing and who is a good coach. Because whenever I hear Buddy Hield speak and whenever I see him play, I don't look at a player, I don't look at him and go, oh, well, he's not a smart player. No, I actually think he's pretty knowledgeable about the game. Like, he'll point out certain patterns and actions and, like, I think he's got something there. Like, he is, there is something in there where I think if he goes to the right organization, he could really have a very enjoyable prime.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think he might be miscast in Sacramento because they're so bereft of top tier talent.
Right.
Where I, you know, can he be the number two offensive option on a title team? I don't think so. But could he be the number four option? Yeah, probably.
He could also be number three. I mean, I was even on the fence with number two. I could go either way. And you go straight to number four?
Well, I'm just saying. I mean, yeah, like, it, depending on which two guys he's playing next to. Like, plug him into Milwaukee next to Giannis and Chris Middleton. Yeah, I think he could do some damage there. Which teams do you think should be after him if he really is up for grabs?
So this is going to sound weird because they already have a shooting guard, and I already brought up his name. The Bulls. I think the Bulls would make sense. I think they should just basically run out a very high prolific shooting lineup. I think that's probably their best bet if they want to hit the playoffs. And it seems like this new regime is very, very interested in them making a splash already next season by making the playoffs. And if you have a team that is just spaced out with Hield and Levine, who also got really in on the three-point action this year, and Lauri Markkanen, who doesn't play under Jim Boylan anymore, and Wendell Carter Jr., who is going to get a different role this year where he's allowed to shoot threes, and you have Kobe White as well, I mean, then you're looking at a team who might actually end up in the top five in three-point shooting, which is going to win you a ton of games in the regular season. Now, is he the best fit necessarily if he has to play the three or Zach has to play the three? Probably not, but in today's somewhat positionless game, I think you can figure it out. Like, they would be horrendous defensively, but if you start off with the offensive component and just run through it, well, I don't see why not. I could definitely see that working. If you're looking at contender-level teams, then it becomes a little bit more difficult solution because then you have to find the contracts, you have to find the value. Most teams that are competing don't really have a whole lot of trade assets because they've already exhausted them by getting the players that made them championship contenders in the first place. So who out there really has a strong package to give up? Like, obviously the Nuggets would be extremely interesting for Buddy Hield because Gary Harris is just not that guy offensively anymore. But what do they have trait wise? Like, they're not going to move Michael Porter Jr. for him.
No, definitely not.
No. So who's out there, that makes sense? Hield is what, 28?
Turning 28 in December, I believe.
Okay. So when next season rolls around, he's going to be 28 years old. So that means OKC is out because they're going to move into like a rebuild. Utah could be interesting because they still need some shooting. Maybe Buddy Hield comes in and plays a type of small forward there. But again, trade assets. Like, what do they have there? Dallas fans love the idea of adding Buddy Hield, and I get why. But again, what do they give up here? I mean, so I think it's difficult to tailor a package for a potential contender that makes a lot of sense. Like, Boston is locked and loaded with their guards and wings. Like, they don't need anyone. Indiana, I know that Tony East, our colleague at Forbes, has brought up Oladipo for Hield, which is, on the surface, is not uninteresting, I should add. But, is that feasible? I don't know. So, to answer your question, I think it's probably Philly that makes the most sense, but what's the package?
Right. So you're telling me the Al Horford package is not enticing?
Yeah, I'm basically telling you that, yes. It's
yes, not I have also been saying that, but right. Sixers Twitter does not want to listen, unfortunately. I guess I'll go back to the Chicago thing in a second, but what should Sacramento be looking for in exchange for Hield? Like, you're set at the one with Fox. You're presumably, if you're going to move on from Hield, you're presumably going to re-sign Bogdan Bogdanovic. Marvin Bagley's a question mark. Harrison Barnes is what he is. Like, I feel like the only position they're definitely set at is the one, and then wherever you're playing Bogdan, the two or the three.
Yeah, and you're probably playing Bogdan at the three, I think, would be best, to be perfectly honest with you. And it's funny, because when you ask me, who would fit next to De'Aaron Fox? Buddy Hield.
right.
I mean, this is why the Kings are just such a frustrating organization, because the right fit is right there. It is on the actual roster, and it's a piece that they're probably going to move. No, but what they should be looking for is, I guess, draft picks and some defense. Look, I'm at that point with the Kings where regardless of what they do, I just have no idea what they are. Are they rebuilding? Are they trying to win now? We read an article more than a few months back basically saying they're desperate to make to the playoffs. So I would presume that draft picks might not be, you know, of tremendous interest, so they need win now players. But who is that guy?
Al Horford.
Look, I don't hate Al Horford. Al Horford would make the Kings, he would give them some symmetry. I don't want to go as far as saying that he's going to make them better, but he would give them some symmetry that they have not had for years. That's all fine and dandy, but that contract is just atrocious.
Yeah, that was a very charitable way to say.
Mm-hmm. Trying to toe the line just right there.
Yeah. I want to go back to the Chicago thing for a second because, you know, the Bulls do have the number four pick in this draft. Would you do, number four and Otto Porter for, I think the Kings are at number 12. So number four and Otto for 12 and Hield?
Yeah, I think that would be interesting. I know that Otto Porter Jr. is supposedly healthy again. And if he is, and he shed the weight that he gained during his time off this season, he would actually be a pretty good fit on the Bulls. And I think the downgrade defensively would be substantial. But given this draft specifically, dropping down eight spots, I wouldn't necessarily think that should be a problem because you can... This draft is such a crapshoot that it's fine. And if you can then upgrade from, offensively at least, from Porter to Hield, sure, why not? Again, the team would be absolutely miserable defensively.
Bad.
No, I'm not disputing that. But at least it'll get them into the playoffs if that's what they want and that's what they seem to be doing. And I would also argue this. Having a team with such potent three-point shooting, they could come into the playoffs and essentially win a series just off of that. Three-point shooting in today's league is just such a volatile weapon that if you have it going for a few games, you can win a playoff series.
Yeah. It's an interesting idea. I mean, I'm with you in thinking the Kings, on paper, should not be looking to move him, but it does feel like this relationship is not going to improve as long as Luke Walton is there, and it doesn't look like Luke Walton is in danger of losing his job anytime soon. So it wouldn't shock me if they do decide to shop him, and I think a lot of teams should be interested, but you're right. Assembling the right package will be the complication, and I'm sure we'll hear a lot more about this in the weeks and months to come between whenever the finals end and the draft and free agency start.
Right.
So let's wrap up now with another possible trade candidate / trade package that we need to discuss is Victor Oladipo, who we've brought up a few times in recent weeks. Mark Berman of the New York Post reported the Knicks do have Chris Paul on their trade radar, but putting together a package for Oladipo is expected to be a higher priority, which, congratulations, Knicks, you figured out the younger, cheaper guard who's better aligned with your timeline is the higher priority. That's step one. That is honestly improvement from the Knicks front office, so that's encouraging. If you're Indiana, what on the Knicks roster interests you enough for a Buddy Hield trade? An Oladipo trade.
Oladipo trade.
Yeah.
The number 8 pick. A guy that they can't get in Mitchell Robinson.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. So I think the Knicks would probably say Barrett and Robinson are off limits.
Right.
I would agree the number 8 pick has to be the foundation of that trade. Mm-hmm. The Knicks are projected to be under the cap depending on what they do with all these guys on team options. So they might not have to salary match, which could help grease the wheels on a deal.
Yeah.
If you're Indiana, would number 8 and Dennis Smith Jr. interest you for Oladipo?
I don't think it's bad value. I think Pacers fans listening in right now would basically say, "What? Like, what? That's nothing, especially in a bad draft." But the fact of the matter is, Oladipo has not played a lot over the past two seasons. He just hasn't. He's coming off a pretty substantial injury. He has not shown he can return to that level that we saw in 2017-2018. Hell, I even wrote an article on that, like basically saying, was that an outlier? And I've raised that question on the pod as well. It's a pretty big question to have hanging over yourself as well. And that's not to crap on Oladipo whatsoever, but it's a question that teams who are considering trading for must ask themselves. Like, what is our expectation of Victor Oladipo if we trade for him? Like, are we expecting him to become our primary number one guy? Is he going to be, like, our second guy or third guy? Is he going to be an expiring contract and that's it? Like, it really boils down to how you gauge him as a player. And if the Knicks view him as, you know, a huge building block, then you are probably willing to give up more than Dennis Smith Jr. number 8. But again, the market dictates what his price is going to be. Who is going to top that price? Is there someone else who's willing to give up a top 5 pick or very attractive young players? I don't know.
Right. I mean, I think it comes down to this from Indiana's perspective. Is I would guess they'll approach him about an extension again this offseason. If he turns it down, you know, and has given some indication seemingly that he does not plan on staying in Indiana beyond 2021, you got to just read the tea leaves. Mm-hmm. And you have to say, okay, are we willing to lose him for nothing? Or even if we aren't getting what we deem to be requisite value for this guy who once was an all-star a few years ago, like, is that better than losing him for nothing or having to deal with the headache of his free agency in 2021, knowing that we don't want to be the team? You know, there's a chance that if we trade him and he's healthy, then he gets back to his old form and this looks terrible for us. But there's also a chance that, unfortunately, like, we don't see the old Victor Oladipo moving forward, and, you know, he's got these nagging health concerns, and then you have to overpay him to keep him there, and that limits your ceiling. So it's, for Indiana, it's, you know, deciding, do you want to be the team that gambles on Victor Oladipo's next contract? And if the answer is no, then this offseason is the time to trade him, even if you're trading him at what looks like 60 cents on the dollar.
Another component we need to take account for is the fact that the Pacers are probably not going to have cap space. Like, even if you get out of Victor Oladipo's contract 100%, you're not going to have a substantial amount of cap space, because Sabonis' contract extension is going to be activated after the conclusion of this season. So he's suddenly going to be earning $17 million. You have Malcolm Brogdon earning almost $21 million. Miles Turner at 18, T.J. Warren at 11.7, and Jeremy Lamb at 10.5. Like, so the money is not going to be there. So if you're Indiana, do you really look at cap relief as an asset at this point? I don't think you do. I think you're right. Mm-hmm. I think they look at it as, well, we have $21 million to kind of play around with. We can match salaries off of $21 million. Let's see what we can get. Maybe we even consider throwing in a draft pick and seeing just what we can get in this deal. Like, can we upgrade Victor Oladipo into something really nice?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm just saying, everything should be on the table here. Everything should be discussed.
Yeah. Do you think if it was 8 and DSJ for Oladipo, is that a deal the Knicks should seriously consider?
No, I don't. I don't think it fits New York's timeline. I don't think it really makes sense for them moving forward. Like, what is that roster anyway? But look, they have hired Tom Thibodeau as their head coach, who loves the defensive-oriented players. So I guess it would make sense for the short term, but the long term, I fear that it would basically, I don't want to say stunt the development of RJ Barrett. That's too harsh. But I do think he would get less opportunities on the ball, and I don't necessarily think that's a good idea.
Mm. Yeah. And I mean, the other thing lingering over Oladipo is there's been enough smoke connecting them to Miami in 2021. And again, we'll see what happens, especially coming off of this finals run, and whether Giannis signs the Supermax this offseason, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, you know, who knows which guys are actually going to be available in that free agent class. And I think if you're choosing between Giannis and Oladipo, it's not much of a choice there.
Right. You go Depot 10 out of 10.
Right. 100%. No question. So, you know, there's a chance that Miami, the threat of Miami is not as real as it seems right now. But I think that is another thing that will, or that could depress his trade market a bit. You know, teams are going to be wondering, are we trading him for a rental? And, you know, even for the Knicks, where it's like, oh, okay, we can get this star level player and we get this splashy guy, and then he's around this dysfunction for a year and pieces out. Now you're out the number eight pick in, yes, a weak draft, but, you know, still just another.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like it could be Kevin Knox, and then you know, it's a wasted pick, but it could be a legitimate contributor.
I love that you had to get that in there.
Well, because what, he was number nine, right? I mean, you know, it's to show that number eight pick sounds really good on paper. But,
I agree. You know. I just like that you had to slide that in there, because look, you're always on my ass for picking up every young player and basically claiming him, but I never claimed Kevin Knox. So
you never did. It's risky to claim any player that goes on the Knicks, honestly.
That's true. Well, I will say Mitchell Robinson, you and I were both pretty optimistic about him coming in. Mm-hmm. And he turned into so much more than we actually thought. So
and now he's still only playing 20 minutes a game because Knicks.
Yeah, because of Knicks. But you know, at least he's hitting threes now.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, I would hope, my God, I would hope he's off limits, because an Oladipo, Barrett, Robinson core, I mean, I agree with you, like, Oladipo doesn't align developmentally with those guys necessarily, but that's interesting, at least. It's more interesting than whatever slop the Knicks threw out on the court last year.
Yeah, no, that's true. And look, I'll go this far as well. If they trade for Oladipo, and if they trade for Chris Paul as well, you know, it will be probably the best Knicks team we've seen since they made the second round.
Mm-hmm. Since the Melo.
Yeah, since Carmelo. The Melo generation. Which is not, which is not a positive thing in and of itself, but...
No.
I mean, oh God, this is so depressing when you really think about it. Because, I mean, when you take a step back, consider what we're trying to do here. We're basically trying to force the Knicks into just being somewhat competitive. Like, that lineup is not going to be good, necessarily. Yeah, they could sneak into the playoffs in the East, and then they would get completely annihilated by whoever they meet in round one. And then you've spent trade assets getting, you know, a guy who's at that point going to be 36, and a guy who might leave after that year, which is just... It wouldn't be good planning. It wouldn't.
Yeah. We're just trying to help the Knicks win 35 games for the first time in 7 years.
Right. Oh, God.
Well, I mean, I've been talking myself into Isaiah Thomas as a vet min target for the Sixers, so I'll be here in a few years, too.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, he just had some sort of hip surgery.
Yeah. So what if that fixed him?
Yeah. Or, you know, generally speaking, when you have hip surgery and you're, you know, in your, what, early 30s?
Yeah.
That's just probably not
a good sign. No, it's a great sign. He feels better than ever, Mort. I'm in. I'm all aboard the IT4 train. No, this is where my mind has been. Just like, which terrible guard are the Sixers are going to sign for a veteran minimum deal? But we'll get to that in due time. In the meantime, I think this is a good place to wrap up.
Yep.
So hope everyone enjoys game four tonight. We will be back later this week, either to bid goodbye to one of these teams or preview another game, hopefully. In the meantime, please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. We're being hosted by Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen. Mort, any TV movie reviews before we go?
Yes, yes, big time. David Attenborough has a new Netflix documentary out called A Life on Our Planet. And it is his witness statement, basically in regards to the globe. And I gave it a 10 out of 10 on IMDb. And it didn't seem like I was wrong, because it is right now 9.2 out of 10. It is a haunting documentary in many ways. It's absolutely sublime. Here we have just a great individual who, over the part of 60 years, have traveled the globe and has seen firsthand the deterioration of our planet, and who is just so fed up with climate change deniers and you know, people not taking climate change seriously, that he's just, you know, he's 94 now, so he basically just decided, you know what, I'm going to make this documentary as my witness statement, because I'm not going to be around for much longer. This is me telling you this is crucial. And what he does, which is so great, I'm not going to, you know, it's tough to spoil this because it's a documentary, but what he does so well, he outlines and proves every problem that we have had and have. And instead of just, like so many other documentaries, just hitting on a sour note going, well, it's all your fault, he actually goes in the past half hour or so and says, well, there's good news, because we can still fix this. And he lays out plans and even shows us examples of certain places around the globe that has already taken certain precautions and certain measurements to actually affect climate change. And and he goes into detail, well, we could do this and that on in a wide variety. And like, he just, his creativity runs amok, but not in a way where you sit back and go, well, that's unrealistic. No, you really get the sense that this is feasible. So he takes you on a very, very emotional journey, and I would just highly recommend that everyone watch it, and because he's got some great ideas, and he's one of the most reliant people, you know, in the history of the world when it comes to having observed nature, having observed the wilderness. I'm not gonna sit here and pretend like I didn't cry my ass off. It was just gorgeous, just fantastic. I'm struggling to find the words, because I'm still moved tremendously by it. So yes, absolutely a movie for you. Go watch it. It's an hour and 23 minutes out of your life. You can afford it. It's a global pandemic right now. You absolutely have the time. Sit your asses down tonight, tomorrow. Watch it. Turn off your phones and just let yourself be moved.
I was gonna say, back in college, I watched a ton of Planet Earth, and I grew to love David Attenborough there, so I was hoping it would be an uplifting, like, Planet Earth Part 3, and it does not sound like that is the case.
This is different, because this is not him telling you about, like, certain animals' tendencies. Like, he's using the footage to basically, you know, detail, you know, where we went wrong, how we went wrong, what have the consequences been. So no, it's not uplifting in the first hour or so, but then he flips it around, as he typically does, you know, being his very optimistic self, and goes, we still have time, but we, you know, we have to act now, but we still have time. And I will say, I mean, some of the things he showed, like, for example, in Morocco, you know, you have those solar panel farms, basically, that are huge, you know, huge solar panel farms. And right now, approximately 40% of their energy comes from that. And he's like, in 2050, Morocco could be in so good shape in the energy market that they could actually export solar energy. And here, it's on a very uplifting note. Let's end the podcast on a very uplifting note. Because what he essentially is coming in at is, you know, solar power is extremely underutilized. So in a single day, the sun gives us 20 times the amount of energy that we spend. So for him, he's basically making the argument, if you can store more solar power and use that for energy purposes, the better. then that is a huge, huge way of getting rid of fossil fuels and like really turning green. And I can't say enough great words about it.
Well, on a lighter note, I started watching the series Last Man on Earth. This is continuing my trend of being like 5 years too late on good sitcoms. And the opening like title credit was 2020, 1 year after the virus, which I just thought was like really hauntingly accurate for a show that came out a few years ago at this point.
Okay, but it's fantastic. Great. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like everyone, or they think everyone is dead. So it starts with just Will Forte. And then, I don't want to spoil too much of it, but I'm only like half a season in so far, but I'm really enjoying it. So after you watch this very depressing, David Attenborough documentary,
no, it's not
check
depressing.
Out.
I've got, no, it's depressing in the first hour, but it actually ends you on a note where you want to take action.
Okay, there we go. Well, after you check out a serious documentary, I should say, watch Last Man on Earth. It's on Hulu, I believe.
Then I have no chance.
you could catch it on, I don't know, maybe it's on another show or another streaming service. Who knows these days? But yeah, strong recommend for,
nice.
Again, if you're like me and you miss every sitcom until it's been out for 5 years, check it out.
I'm just glad you didn't like end up following David Attenborough by, you know, pitching some, you know, what's it called, like reality TV show.
Oh no, no!
Like, I'm sitting there going on and on for 10 minutes about this great documentary. You'll be like, "Hey, you know what? X on the Beach is fantastic."
All right, that show is really good, and I need more of it in my life. Oh, all right. God. One more. I'll catch you later. Stay safe out there, my man.
Later, man. Don't die.